to Steve Bannon last year, and that federal prosecutors violated Justice Department rules in filing charges. It was not clear on Tuesday, 7th of June, whether a letter to House counsel would move to quash the trial subpoenas. Letter, though a spokesman for the Select Committee, could not be reached for comment. Doug Letter could also move to reach an arrangement with David Schoen, the lead lawyer defending Steve Bannon in his contempt case. David Schoen told The Guardian he would be prepared to discuss the matter in the hope that Doug Letter would not move to dismiss the subpoenas. David Schoen said, "The subpoenas are asking for materials that belong to the American people. It will be pretty ironic for the committee to quash the subpoenas when they issued a subpoena demanding materials from Steve Bannon, where Trump asserted executive privilege." Bannon's lawyers are making a multi-pronged defense to try and save Bannon from being convicted of criminal contempt of Congress after he was referred to the Justice Department for prosecution for failing to comply with a subpoena in the Congressional 6th of January inquiry. The main thrust of Steve Bannon's argument is that he cannot be held in willful contempt because he could reasonably believe the subpoena was invalid when the Select Committee failed to allow a Trump lawyer to attend his deposition after Donald Trump asserted executive privilege. The argument rests on a 2019 Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel opinion that says congressional subpoenas that prevent executive branch counsel from accompanying executive branch employees to depositions are legally invalid and not enforceable. Steve Bannon's lawyers are also making the case that the Select Committee, in violation of House rules, made no effort to grant a one-week extension to reply to the subpoena after his testimony asked for time to review Donald Trump's related lawsuit against the panel. The defense that Steve Bannon is advancing, using broad readings of parts of the Justice Department's own positions and amalgamating them into a wider argument, is controversial, but it underscores the complexities facing federal prosecutors in pursuing this case. Jonathan Schober, University of Kentucky law professor and former Office of Legal Counsel attorney advisor, previously told The Guardian, "Steve Bannon trying to use the Office of Legal Counsel opinions as a shield that doesn't quite cover him, but gives him enough of a defense to fend off the Department of Justice's necessity of proving criminal intent." Meanwhile, in another development, Donald Trump's campaign directed Republican Party operatives named as alternative electors in Georgia to operate with complete secrecy and discretion, as the then-president attempted to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden. CNN and The Washington Post reported that startling direction was contained in an email, which is part of a U.S. Justice Department investigation. Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden by more than 7 million ballots in the popular vote and by 302 to 236 in the Electoral College, the same margin that Trump called a landslide when it was in his favor over Hillary Clinton in 2016. Pursuing the lie that Biden's win was the result of fraud, the Trump campaign sought to overturn his Electoral College defeat in part by appointing its own electors in seven key states. On 13th of December 2020, a Georgia campaign official, Robert Sinners, emailed alternative electors due to gather the next day. He wrote, "I must ask for you complete discretion in this process. Your duties are imperative to ensure the end result, a win in Georgia for President Trump, but will be hampered unless we have complete secrecy and complete discretion." The alternate electors were together at the State House in Atlanta, Georgia. Robert Sinners told them, "Please, at no point should you mention anything to do with presidential electors or speak to the media." The meeting did not take place in secret, as local media filmed it.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's in effect another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. And Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now, that established beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbass and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after launch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every 5 children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms, because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
Tehran has blasted the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, held talks with the Israeli regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Tel Aviv, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry has warned of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its director general kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv came in the backdrop of a report by the IAEA alleging that Iran has not clarified the presence of nuclear material at three sites. Khatibzadeh, pointing to the UN nuclear body's blatant double standards, said the world powers cannot overlook Israel's weapons program while indulging in rhetoric about Iran's peaceful atomic program. Israel has never signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. Tel Aviv possesses the largest number of nuclear warheads in the region and has never allowed IAEA inspectors to scrutinize its nuclear sites. On the other hand, Iran, despite being a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, continues to reel under harsh sanctions for pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused Iran of stealing classified documents from the IAEA and using them to deceive international inspectors nearly two decades ago. Iran rejected the allegations as outright lies. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors is scheduled to hold a meeting on Monday, with all eyes on the agency's latest report. The meeting is reportedly set to adopt an anti-Iran resolution drafted by Britain, France, Germany, and the United States to accuse the Islamic Republic of withholding cooperation with the agency. Israel backs the draft resolution to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately.
The right to resist this kind of bullying and coercion and sort of domination from the West, that right to resist is not allowed. You were never allowed to resist. And anything Iran does to preserve its independence is going to be labeled as dangerous and subversive somehow to the international order, and on and on and on.
Iran says the visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel ahead of the meeting of the Board of Governors is in contradiction with the agency's principles of observing impartiality and maintaining its technical and professional status. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, while pointing to the destructive measures of the Zionist regime, which is the main culprit of illegal nuclear activities in the world. Amir Abdollahian censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. He reiterated Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. Iran's foreign minister also said his country will immediately, effectively, and proportionately respond to any political move against Tehran at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Joseph Borrell, for his part, censured what he called some attempts to undermine the Vienna talks.
He urged all the parties involved to continue the dialogue to change the current negative atmosphere pervading the IAEA. The Board of Governors meeting will come as a pause in the marathon negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal has entered its third month, with prospects described by Washington as tenuous at best. Tehran blames the US and its three European allies, France, Britain, and Germany, for failing to act constructively.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a US-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.
Well, the United States certainly has backed the Kurdish operations to carve up Syria, to carve up Iraq, to basically split, divide, and conquer that whole region into ethnic strife and competition. That is one of the sore points between the U.S. and Turkey is the Kurds, because Turkey sees them as an enemy to be destroyed, whereas the U.S. sees the Kurds as a pawn, as a tool to use in destabilizing Syria, President Bashar Assad, and create endless civil war and conflict there.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors of the Astana peace process and have been mediating peace negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition since 2017. Any rifts between the three could derail the talks and damage any progress they have achieved.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansiel, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Investigation Shows Hundreds of U.S. Cops Being Trained by Far-Right Extremists. Here's more. Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published recently to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Reuters identified five law enforcement trainers who have been hired by police and sheriff's departments nationwide despite their support for right-wing militia groups, including the Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and Three Percenters. The QAnon conspiracy, which baselessly claims that Democrats and Hollywood stars belong to a cabal of Satanists, pedophiles, and cannibals, and former President Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Some use bigoted instructional materials that promote racism, misogyny, and many people endorse the constitutional sheriff philosophy, which maintains that country sheriffs should refuse to uphold any law they find unconstitutional. Reuters reported adherence to the constitutional sheriff movement considered the federal government a grave threat to U.S. citizens. They argue that local law enforcement is a higher authority with the power to countermand the decisions of legislatures, courts, and presidents. Richard Whitehead, one of dozens of active and retired police officers or trainers who were listed in a database of members of the Oath Keepers, has called for public executions of government officials he sees as disloyal to Trump, Reuters reported. In a 2020 social media post, he urged cops to disobey COVID-19 public health orders from tyrannical governors, adding, "We are on the brink of civil war." During his day job, the Idaho-based law enforcement consultant has taught at least 560 police officers and other public safety workers in 85 sessions in 12 states over the past 4 years, noted the news outlet, which analyzed public records from departments that hired him.
He's one of the five police trainers identified by Reuters whose political commentary on social media has echoed extremist opinions or who have public ties to far-right figures, the news outlet added. They work for one or more of 35 training firms that advertised at least 10 police or public safety training sessions in 2021. Whitehead, Daryl Schneck, Adam Davis, Tim Kennedy, and Ryan Morris are tapping into a lucrative business opportunity that likely wouldn't exist if U.S. police officers were adequately prepared during their initial job training, Reuters reported. The lessons promoted in their private courses, meanwhile, might be less dangerous for civilians if states had more funding to set standards and provide oversight. As the news outlet explained, private trainers work in an unregulated industry that largely has evaded the heightened scrutiny of U.S. policing in recent years in the wake of high-profile police killings of civilians. Trainers like those identified by Reuters, a half-dozen police training specialists say, highlight a lack of standards and oversight that allows instruction that can often exaggerate the threats that officers face, making them more likely to respond with excessive force in stressful situations. U.S. law enforcement officers receive far less initial training at police academies than their counterparts in comparable countries, said Arjun Sethi, a Georgetown University adjunct law professor and policing specialist. That opens immense commercial opportunities for private trainers to fill the void, with ongoing training of active duty officers, often in a politicized manner that normalizes biased policing against Black people and other communities, he said. Private trainers typically advertise their courses to police and sheriff's departments, who often pay for their officers to take them. But individuals can also seek out and pay for courses on their own to satisfy government or department requirements for ongoing training. The courses vary widely in content and in price from hundreds to thousands of dollars per attendee. State-based oversight institutions, often called peace officer standards and training agencies, set requirements for police training, such as the types of classes and minimum teaching hours that officers must complete. But the institutions have little power in most states to influence course content or set standards for private police trainers, in part due to budget constraints, said Randy Strawberry, a former police officer. He saw unregulated police training as such a problem that in 2017, he founded the California-based Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Cops who perceive a far-right trainer as authoritative and credible may end up adopting their ideology, said Strawberry, adding bad training is instilling bad behavior. According to a 2019 analysis of historical FBI data published in the journal Criminology and Public Policy, the number of line duty deaths has declined dramatically over the last 5 decades. Police deaths per 100,000 officers fell by 75% over the past half century, from 81 in 1970 to 20 in 2016. Deaths from felonies decreased even more than accidental deaths during that time. In light of such data showing declining dangers to officers, many training agencies long ago abandoned training that emphasized putting officers through simulations of threatening situations, Reuters reported. That's the worst kind of training to give officers today, to make them to feel more vulnerable, said Jill Kurlewski, who led the police departments of Buffalo and Seattle between 1994 and 2009, adding, "You want people to have an awareness of violent threats, but you don't want them to be so hypersensitive that it impacts everything they do." Although the War on Cops thesis is not supported by any evidence, as the 2019 study concluded, individual trainers have wide latitude to teach America's police officers whatever they see fit due to the lack of regulation, Reuters noted. The news outlet added the mindset that trainers impact, such as a feeling of constant vulnerability, can be more influential than the technical knowledge they share, said Thetz Staunton, a law professor at the University of South Carolina and former police officer with expertise in law enforcement training. Staunton said studies show that training which overemphasizes life-threatening situations can impart a warrior mentality, convincing the officers that they face constant deadly threats. In a promotional video that Kennedy released in 2020, Chris Jackson, an officer who works for a California police agency operated by a Native American tribe, said Kennedy's course had opened his eyes to the world and changed the way he would respond to threats. "You never want to be a victim of anything," he said in the video. Jackson told Reuters in an interview that the training, which his agency paid for, made him more aware of potential threats and prepared to respond with less hesitation. He said, "Sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do to eliminate the threats." More than 5,000 people in the United States of America have been shot and killed by cops since 2015, including 1,050 in the past year alone. Police kill civilians in the U.S. at a far higher rate than their counterparts in comparable countries.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. The best means for inviting to the good is through action. Action in the area of inviting to do good. Therefore, entrance into the area of jihad is a clear, definite responsibility for religious scholars and Muslim clerics. There are no doubts about this. A person who withdraws from the field of jihad must know that this field is the foundation. Fortunately, this spirit is present among our honorable clerics. Some individuals have listed these martyrs. The late Amini, may God bestow paradise on him, the author of Al-Qadir, wrote a book named The Martyrs of Virtue, in which he listed the martyred religious scholars throughout history. Of course, he did not list all of them. He was able to find some of them. He listed the martyred religious scholars from the 4th and 5th centuries onward. He did not list the ones before that. There are also individuals who were martyred or who fought in the area of jihad, but who did not achieve martyrdom. But they did jihad in the way of God. Their names have not been mentioned in such books. Well, this is an honorable culture of the Muslim clerics, and I hope that this spirit and this way will continue, God willing.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I advise the dear friends and brothers who organize these commemoration congresses to not look at these congresses as being an end in themselves. They are a means. In addition to these commemoration congresses, many other actions must also be done. Finding the right method for such work requires thinking together. Individuals who are intellectuals and who are interested in culture and art should sit together and find the various ways to do this. As I mentioned before, remembering their names, publishing their photos, biographies and wills, and explaining the circumstances in which they entered into jihad are very important tasks. These must be published, and I hope that everyone will benefit from the spiritual lessons to be learned from those great personages. I hope that God will bless you and make you successful and help you to do what is necessary in this regard. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The US president has gradually morphed into a carbon copy of Trump when it comes to West Asia policy, says David Hurst, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden is fiddling as Al-Quds burns. Stay tuned for more. Quietly and without a murmur, the West Asia policy of U.S. President Joe Biden appears to be performing what stunt writers call a handbrake turn. Biden is veering away from his signature policy and lurching towards Saudi normalization with the Israeli regime, which was the major piece of unfinished business of former President Donald Trump's Abraham Accords. After this stunt has been performed, Biden's West Asia policy will be all but indistinguishable from Trump's. For all his naked mercantilist ambitions, backing illegitimate despots in return for his 30 pieces of silver, Trump's legacy in West Asia is enduring. Having denounced both its de facto ruler and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia itself as a pariah state, Biden seems to be only too willing to deal with pariahs. He's following sheep-like in Trump's footsteps. As is by now well known, the Crown Prince and future King of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, has set normalization with the fabricated regime of Israel as his primary foreign policy goal. Coming up to then, Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in clandestine meetings was the young prince's path to getting his name recognized by the White House and to building a relationship with the Trump dynasty. But his father, King Salman, still retains ownership of and pride in Saudi Arabia's brokerage of the Arab Peace Initiative 2 decades ago, which promised Arab recognition of the fabricated regime of Israel only once it reached a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians. This was the last serious opportunity for a regional peace deal, and at the time it was ignored by the Zionist regime. The Abraham Accords have reversed this principle by sidelining Palestinians, whose fate is irrelevant to the deals being made between the UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, Morocco, and the fake regime of Israel. Biden, whose administration started by echoing King Salman's concerns about the Abraham Accords, is now falling increasingly into an unholy embrace with his son. It's unlikely to work to report on a conflict, as Shirin Abu Akleh died for Al Jazeera is to court a targeted Israeli regime sniper attack, which Al Jazeera is now bringing to the International Criminal Court as a war crime perpetrated by the Zionist regime. To bury her body is to court the blows and bullets of Israeli regime police. To fly a Palestinian flag is apparently now licensed for lethal force from those who get heavy police escorts to parade Israeli regime flags all around Palestinian headquarters. Asked specifically to condemn the police attacks on the coffin bearers, Biden gave a Trump-like response, saying, "I don't know all the details, but I know it has to be investigated." When Trump was confronted by evidence that his protege MBS had ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, he said something similar. It could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. We may never know all the facts surrounding the murder of Mr. Jamal Khashoggi. Both U.S. presidents deliberately and persistently looked the other way to foster an alliance between the two least stable forces in West Asia, the Zionist regime and Saudi Arabia. How much longer Biden can look away on events about to unfold in Al-Quds is another matter. The Judaization of occupied East Al-Quds, the now weekly police raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque, the calls for Dome of the Rock to be dismantled, the attacks on Palestinians waving their national flag, all make this city a far more potent bomb. Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy there, followed by a Biden administration that refuses to move on its promise to reopen its consulate for Palestinians in occupied East Al-Quds, leaves Washington incapable of applying a brake on the Zionist regime's plans for the city. U.S. foreign policy has been taken by surprise on too many occasions in the last 3 decades. The U.S. regime was surprised by the results of its invasion of Iraq. It was surprised by the sudden collapse of Kabul after so much time and money had been spent propping it up.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country, and that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well, and we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where, in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner. Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public health care has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good healthcare.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and disposition of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed.